From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young, broadcasting today from WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. That sound from a cell phone video provided to the British newspaper The Independent from St. Petersburg, Russia, where an explosion on a subway train killed at least 9 people today. A spokesman for the city's governor also said about 50 people were injured. The National Anti-Terrorist Committee announced that it also found an explosive device at another subway station, but neutralized it. Joining us now via Skype is Charles Maines in Moscow, who's following the story for NPR. Charles, what do we know about what caused the explosion?
Well, investigators are saying that it's a homemade explosive device that they found in an abandoned bag in the metro car. That the device was apparently placed in. Special services here also claim they have video surveillance footage of what they say is the suspect. Russian media are already calling him the Petersburg terrorist. And in fact, just a few minutes ago, the photo was released online. It appears to be a bearded individual wearing what resembles, anyway, certainly most Russians would associate it with the dress of people from the Northern Caucasus region, although certainly there are many ethnicities there, and it's tough to say.
Hmm. And I imagine some people would be skeptical of that, just given the relationship between the Putin government and people from the Caucasus.
Well, that's true. But, you know, keep in mind now that Russia has been involved in this campaign, this military campaign in Syria now for over a year and a half. They went in a sense, ostensibly, initially Putin basically justified this move into Syria by saying that that fighters, Islamic insurgents from the Northern Caucasus region, in other words, within the Russian Federation, were on the field fighting alongside ISIS, Islamic State. And so he argued that one of the reasons for going into Syria to begin with was to take the fight to these terrorists in Syria rather than have them come home. We've certainly seen also cases where Russia is certainly no stranger to terrorist attacks, and Petersburg in particular. If you remember back to October of 2015, it was a charter flight coming from Egypt back to St. Petersburg that exploded over the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt,
right,
killing 200 people. Most of them were from St. Petersburg. So I think clearly it's on the minds of many there.
Well, and give us a sense for people who have not been to St. Petersburg. This is obviously a major tourist destination in Russia, one of the largest cities in Russia. But give us a sense of where this happened in the city. This was right in the heart of it.
Sure. This was at Sinai Ploshchad Station. This is exactly in the heart of the city, just not too far off of Nevsky Prospekt, which is the central thoroughfare in St. Petersburg. You know, St. Petersburg is a town full of canals and it's a port city. So in some ways, the metro is the heart of getting around St. Petersburg because there are many complicated drawbridges, a lot of traffic getting from one island to another. And it's also a very deep metro. That's something important to note because it's a heavily traveled metro, but very, very deep underground because of the fact that St. Petersburg was built essentially on water. So in other words, it made the evacuation today even much more chaotic, given that for rescuers to get down into the metro station was very difficult.
And what's been the response from President Putin, who was in St. Petersburg today for a speech and a meeting?
That's right. President Putin was in St. Petersburg this morning meeting with his National Popular Front Forum. This is a pro-Putin coalition that essentially it works outside of politics, but to try and improve the image of the president. And certainly he's looking ahead to the presidential elections here in 2018. So that's where he was this morning. He's actually meeting with Alexander Lukashenko, the Belarusian president, outside of Petersburg today. When he was informed of the explosion in St. Petersburg in the metro, he said that he expressed condolences, of course, to the victims. He promised all sorts of, that officials would do whatever they could. He's also conferred with the FSB, the investigators into the cause of the explosion. He's not ruling anything out, he says.
And Charles, one other thing I want to note is that there have been some pretty significant protests across Russia in recent days, anti-corruption protests. Is there any thought that there's any link to that?
Well, there's no direct connection, of course, but Russians are no strangers to conspiracy theories. These protests that you mentioned, they were just recently, earlier this month, tens of thousands came out to the streets to protest the government. There was some talk after that somehow, the authorities might try and find some way to essentially resurrect support for the government. And in the past, we've seen Mr. Putin do this with some foreign escapades, for example, the annexation of Crimea, or his entrance into the Syrian campaign to try and distract from domestic problems. So certainly there are voices out there who say that this perhaps was a way to distract from these growing calls for against government corruption and essentially around the presidential bid of the leader of the opposition, Alexei Navalny, here.
That's Charles Maines speaking with us from Moscow about the explosion today in St. Petersburg, Russia, and we'll continue to follow the latest developments. Charles, thank you.
Thank you.
And to Washington now, where the Senate Judiciary Committee is expected to confirm Judge Neil Gorsuch and send his nomination to the full Senate later this week. But in debate today, Democrats on the committee, including Vermont's Patrick Leahy, remain opposed.
I cannot recall a nominee refusing to answer such basic questions about the principles underlying our Constitution and about how he interprets those principles. These are fundamental questions that we should ask every nominee seeking a lifetime appointment to our highest court.
It's also been a big week in diplomacy for President Trump. Leaders of Egypt, Jordan, and China all visiting this week. NPR Politics editor Domenico Montanaro is here to set the table for us. Hi, Domenico.
Hi there, Robin.
And staying with the Gorsuch nomination, it's one thing for Democrats to say they won't vote for Gorsuch, but it's another to say whether they'll filibuster his vote and force Republicans to pull the trigger on what's called the nuclear option, reducing the number of votes needed. So explain, first of all, what we're hearing today from Democrats on that decision.
Well, we're pretty much headed for this quote-unquote nuclear showdown where the rules will be changed in the Senate, most likely by Mitch McConnell, the Republican majority leader, because there have not been enough Democrats to come forward at this point to say that they will at least vote to end debate to be able to advance the nomination of Gorsuch. And if that's the case, Mitch McConnell has been saying one way or another, Gorsuch would be confirmed. And if that happens, if they eliminate the 60-vote threshold, then you're looking at a Senate that is fundamentally changed forever and potentially a Supreme Court that is as well. And the Supreme Court had been something that was an institution that was widely respected. And if you start putting judges on the court that are less than qualified and strictly partisan, it would fundamentally change the way the court operates.
Well, so again, if Republicans don't have the 60 votes they need for the simple majority vote, they'd have to go with this nuclear option. I hate the word for it, but that's
Me
what
too.
It is, because it would have such a profound effect. And as you said, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell over the weekend has been saying it's going to happen one way or the other, indicating he's willing to pull that trigger. But so it's real brinksmanship here. What do the Democrats lose? You say it could fundamentally change the court. What does each side lose?
Well, if you think about what happens next, I mean, if one of the Supreme Court justices who's now, in their 80s or close to 80, who are more, lean more liberal, well, the next person that gets selected, remember, Gorsuch is is replacing Antonin Scalia, who is very conservative. But the next person who gets replaced, that would mean that Republicans could be able to get through whomever they wanted, essentially, as long as they could get 51 votes and wouldn't have to think about the Democrats to say that they need 60. Of course, Democrats also are saying, well, they could just change the rules then if they wanted to. So, of course, there is that argument.
Yeah, okay.
Republicans, they don't want to. There are some Republicans who don't want to change this rule. They could be blamed for fundamentally changing things. But, their short-term win is more important to them, it seems, at this point.
Well, just to touch on what's going on elsewhere, Donald Trump, the president, meeting with the Egyptian president today. This is a general-turned-politician. President Obama never invited him to the White House. And then meetings during the week. And there's a lot of news about Trump's son-in-law and special advisor Jared Kushner's involvement in some of these foreign affairs. He is in Iraq today, which surprised a lot of people. Later this week, there's the meeting between Trump and the Chinese president at Mar-a-Lago. Kushner apparently played a big role in that. And the Times reporting today that the Chinese view him as the role, the road, the path to the White House. Some people are saying, why isn't he Secretary of State?
Well, he's certainly somebody who holds a strong influence within the White House. What I think is interesting here, though, is that, you know, we were talking about Gorsuch and now we're talking about foreign policy. Those are the two areas that a president can more fundamentally affect than this domestic agenda that has been somewhat stalled from President Trump and Republicans. And what we've seen from the United States is stepped up military engagement, something that hasn't gotten as much attention. And that is critical. It's important. I mean, if the United States and Trump taking somewhat of a hands-off approach to it, and if the U.S. engages more in other countries and you wind up having something go badly, that is one area between that and the economy where a president is really held, can be held accountable. You know, this Egyptian meeting is really interesting because President Obama, like you said, never invited Sisi to the White House. He had a tense relationship with him, cut off military aid for months. Sisi has cracked down on political and civil rights. And Trump, on the other hand, is saying, well, maybe they'll talk about that discreetly, but he'd like to reboot the relationship.
Domenico Montanaro, NPR politics editor. Another big week, but aren't they all lately? Domenico, thank you so much.
Thank you.
When President Trump recently signed that executive order to dismantle President Obama's Clean Power Plan, which would have reduced carbon emissions from fossil fuel-powered plants, Trump said he was delivering on his campaign promise to restore coal mining jobs by eliminating regulations. Other moves, Trump says, will help promote a stronger American economy include removing some rules governing methane emissions from oil and gas wells and opening the door to the possibility of rolling back car fuel efficiency standards. Well, much of it must feel like a sledgehammer to our next guest, former Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, who's also a nuclear physicist. He recently returned to teach at MIT. Secretary Moniz, what words would you use to describe the president's actions?
Clearly, watching what's happening in Washington raises a lot of concerns. Certainly, the president's actions on climate change are a big step back. What I mean is that clearly it will make it very difficult, more difficult certainly to meet our Paris goals, for example, for emissions. Although I do want to say, without being Pollyannish, that the die is cast. We're not going back after Paris. The world is heading to low carbon.
Well, hold on a second. The Paris Agreement, cutting coal emissions was part of the pledge to lower emissions by 26% below 2005 levels by 2025. But the thinking now is, how can you possibly make that? You say the die is cast, but how can that goal possibly be met if the clean power plan with concerning power plant emissions is rolled back as it has been?
No, the die is cast in terms of heading to a low carbon future. Meeting the quantitative goals in 2020 or 2025, that will certainly be made more difficult here. However, speaking of coal, let's talk about that. I still expect no new coal plants to be built. The reality is the decrease in coal use, the loss of coal jobs, has been primarily driven by low-cost natural gas.
It's not just that. We've had coal miners on with recent reports that black lung is back among, you know, sometimes retired coal miners. The jobs aren't there because they've been mechanized. The New York Times had an incredible story about these truck haulers that are self-driving. There's not even somebody on a remote driving them around these coal mines.
Right. An interesting fact is that the number of tons of coal produced per worker in Wyoming, let's say, is nearly 10 times that of West Virginia, because in Wyoming, they have this highly mechanized surface mining. In fact, an irony of the president's actions is that he also eliminated the moratorium on coal leases on federal lands. If that is exercised, that will further tip the balance towards Western coal, which has very, very few jobs associated with it, from Eastern coal. Long term, I honestly just don't see that this is going to have an enormous impact, because carbon dioxide emissions accumulate. If we emit more now, we'll have to cut our budget of emissions even more in the future. So all this is doing is making it harder and more expensive in the long term. And the number of jobs lost in, let's say, coal is measured in the couple of tens of thousands. The number of jobs created in the solar industry is about 280,000. The problem is they're not in the same place.
Right.
And so the macro economy may actually be better off, but we have local stresses. And so I believe, frankly, that we've not done a good enough job, I think, in working bottom up to look at what workers need, what communities need to be helped through a period of transition.
We've talked to a lot of economists who say this is one of the first times in American history where people haven't gotten up and moved to where the jobs are. So, for instance, the coal miners maybe in Virginia are not going to wherever the solar would be, maybe Southern California. That's just not happening.
Part of the stress, of course, is the rapid increase in the use of information technology, which in some sense could be used to permit people to not move and yet have work. However, that presumes a high degree of education and the ability to get these transferable skills. And I think that's where, again, we have not probably done enough. And I might add, we will need policy as well to go along with innovation that reduces the cost of new technologies. In my view, a major problem with what the young administration has done, it's not only what came out with the executive order, but it's also what came out as a draft budget from the Office of Management and Budget.
Let me ask you about that and also ask you about the overall disdain in this administration for the global agreement that climate change is largely man-made. Here is the president's director of the Office of Management and Budget, Mick Mulvaney, speaking a couple weeks ago about what monies were going to be spent on climate change.
I think the president was fairly straightforward. Is that we're not spending money on that anymore. We consider that to be a waste of your money to go out and do that. So that is a specific tie to his campaign.
Ernest Moniz, what did you think when you heard that?
Well, I think that is, first of all, just plain economically short-sighted. The global trend to low carbon has been estimated, for example, by the International Energy Agency, to lead to about a $60 trillion investment globally in green energy technologies over the next couple of decades. That is an enormous market. We should be doubling down on our innovation budget so that we, in fact, capture the gains from that. That's where we will create more jobs. The budget, as was put out, claiming we're not going to throw good money after bad.
Meaning climate change
is completely misguided. What it's doing is hurting our competitive edge. And in fact, it's going to set up some precedent in the future to repeat what has been said recently. Why is China taking all these jobs from us? Well, how about because we are giving up our edge in innovation? China is fully prepared to take whatever leadership role it can in climate, both in terms of the global discussion, but I would say even more pointedly in terms of developing the technology base to, in fact, capture market share.
Let's talk about Rick Perry. During the primary debate, he famously said he wanted to abolish the Energy Department, which you once led. He forgot what it was called. But you surprised us, Ernest Moniz, by saying on Fareed Zakaria's program that you were kind of impressed by him in some ways. Tell us more.
Well, the statement he made came from, bluntly, he's not the only one who did not have a full understanding of what the Department of Energy does. I will give him credit that in his confirmation hearing, he did not wait for a question. He just addressed the issue head on and said, look, now that I've been nominated as Energy Secretary, I've looked at it. I now understand the full range of what this department does to contribute to American needs, and I was wrong. And certainly in his words, he has, right from the beginning, upon confirmation, emphasized the importance of national laboratories, of R&D, of innovation.
Well, what have you heard since then?
Well, I know that on his first day on the job, he held a town hall meeting, and I know he certainly said the right things about again, the innovation agenda, the R&D agenda, the nuclear security agenda. Unfortunately, however, especially on the energy innovation front, he made some very positive statements after becoming secretary about the importance. And then I don't know how else to say it other than being undercut by the OMB budget, which in fact zeroed out a program that was, in some sense, the face of innovation ARPA-E, Advanced Research Projects Agency Energy. First 200 projects that were completed by ARPA-E led to 36 companies being formed. It led to well over $1 billion of private capital coming in. It's all the measures that you would think Democrats and Republicans alike would applaud.
And Rick Perry tweeted about it.
He said it's exactly the kind of innovators we need to support. And then the Mulvaney announcement on the budget said, with very little detail, it went out of its way to point out this program would be zeroed out. I do not understand the logic.
This is a sledgehammer.
There's no doubt. It's certainly been a blunt instrument applied up to now. And I will say that from everything I know, there certainly are serious morale problems. Another issue true in just about every agency is that below the leader, there's nobody home in terms of the senior political appointees who go through the Senate confirmation process.
Because they're not in yet. And these aren't held up. They're just not appointed.
They're not only not in, they haven't been nominated.
Yeah.
But I have great expectation and hope that in terms of the budget, for example, the Congress will put forward a budget that is much more balanced. I believe flat out the budget as proposed is dead on arrival.
That's former Secretary of the Energy Department Ernest Moniz, who's now back at MIT. A nuclear physicist. While you have an administration, Scott Pruitt, for instance, head of the EPA, filed lawsuits against the EPA 16 times when he was Oklahoma's attorney general, you have a disdain for science across the board. How do we heal this divide?
What has to be described as an assault on science in many, many, many dimensions, climate denial among them, is part of a bigger pattern of what is now often called alternative facts. And I consider this to be one of the most serious developments that we have seen over the last 10 weeks. What could be more essential for the functioning of a democracy than fact-based discussions, which can lead to very, very different views in terms of how to address the facts. But if we can't even have the facts straight, sometimes I have to say it would appear intentionally. It goes, I think, to the very, very core of our democracy. And I think we have a lot of introspection and dialogue and action that we need to take in civil society to restore fact-based discussions.
Former Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week. Change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/here. Go now and get your first 3 meals free, plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
In an era of standardized testing and crowded schedules, school districts are struggling to figure out how to work recess into the day. In Tennessee, the problem is being debated in the state legislature. Chaz Sisk of Here and Now contributor WPLN in Nashville reports.
Children run, leap, and laugh on a neighborhood playground without a care in the world. But at many schools, there's been less and less time for this sort of thing. Educators blame high-stakes testing and mandates that so much time be dedicated to core subjects. Charlie Friedman, though, is a believer in free play.
Whether you're a young child or honestly you're an adult, I think getting up and moving stimulates your brain and keeps you alert and awake and is part of just being a well-rounded human.
So Friedman, the founder of Nashville Classical, a charter school, stresses playtime. Phys ed, brain breaks, and 30 minutes of recess each day, no matter the weather.
So even indoors, right, you can run centers and you can have games and blocks and action figures and Play-Doh and any number of activities that children can do that's, again, less structured and there's choice and variety.
Those might sound like fun things to do, but under a law passed last year in Tennessee, it's not clear they count as recess. Many educators say that law is too restrictive. For one thing, it sets firm rules on how long recess should be. Kindergartners and first graders in public schools, including charters, have to take 3 15-minute breaks each day. Older elementary students must take 2 20-minute breaks, and they have to be non-structured, meaning teachers can't lead them in play. So earlier this year, Republican Bill Dunn proposed repealing the requirement. That would have given control back to the districts.
A lot of school systems were just ignoring the law, and that's never a good position to be in.
The arguments for recess include better behavior, fighting obesity, even making sure children are prepared to serve one day in the armed forces. And recess isn't the only debate over playtime going on in Tennessee. Another measure before state lawmakers would make schools offer elementary students at least 2 30-minute PE classes a week. Joan Cronin, a former athletic director at the University of Tennessee, testified in favor of the PE bill. She sees a wide variety of benefits.
Research shows that active kids do better. And I think if we look at our elementary students and we look at what they can do to get better and represent us not only in the military but in life, I feel strongly that physical education in the elementary school provides that.
Parents have also been supportive of giving kids more playtime. Republican Roger Kane says there's a widespread perception that the school day has become too crowded with academic requirements.
They like the fact that we've implemented recess back into the school day. It had been relegated to 45 minutes a week, which is totally unacceptable.
A compromise is now making its way through the Tennessee legislature that will give schools more flexibility about which activities are allowed and whether teachers can take part. Kane says he was surprised to hear schools had struggled so much with the issue.
Who knew recess could be so complicated? It seems just like fun.
State lawmakers say if they find these new rules don't work, they'll come back to the issue a third time. The important thing, most agree, is to strike a balance between class time and playtime. For Here and Now, I'm Chaz Sisk in Nashville.
At last check, just 6% of California is in some level of drought. It has been a very wet winter. There's so much snow in the Sierra Nevada mountains that state water officials are preparing for a huge spring runoff. The traditional way of calculating the snowpack has a margin of error that's very big. But as Ezra David Romero from Valley Public Radio reports, there's a new way to measure the snowpack that could greatly decrease that inconsistency.
Every year around this time, a network of snow surveyors manually tally how much of the white stuff is in the Sierra Nevada. They do this by measuring snow depth in the same spots year after year. Pacific Gas and Electric hydrographer Christine Borman and I hopped out of a helicopter in 2014 in the mountains east of Fresno to do this. As we snowshoed to a spot where snow levels have been recorded since 1928, she pierced the snow with a hollow aluminum tube.
And this seems pretty soft, so I'm going to let it go down pretty easily.
49, so 8 inches of water pressure.
Crews like Borman's either ski or fly in to collect their measurements. But that could change with the use of new technology. A 4-year pilot project between NASA, the California Department of Water Resources, and local water authorities is measuring the snowpack from the sky. They're using planes that shoot out laser pulses to detect how deep the snowpack is and how much water is in it. It started out as a test project on the Tuolumne watershed 4 years ago and is now being used on the San Joaquin River watershed. Kat Borman is one of the NASA scientists who work on the plane.
It has two laser sources situated within the unit itself. We can push out 800,000 points per second with this unit.
Those pulses bounce back to the unit and combined create a map of the area. The team flies a plane over the region when there's no snow, and then again at the start of each month from February to April. Then they subtract the first value from the second to determine the snow depth. Tom Painter is a NASA scientist who came up with the idea. He says to think of the old system of manual surveys like a computer screen with only a few pixels working.
You don't ever actually know what the actual picture is, whereas we're turning on every pixel on the screen.
Painter says this is a big deal because manual surveys can be off by 20 to 60%. The trial flyovers of the Tuolumne watershed saw measurements that were only about 2% off.
That uncertainty that's been a part of water management in the western U.S. is going to go away.
The second set of data from the flyovers of the San Joaquin watershed from March show there's 2.7 million acre-feet of snow waiting to melt in the mountains east of Fresno. Jeff Payne is the Water Resources and Operations Coordinator for the Fryant Water Authority.
And they found depths of 50 feet in some of the avalanche areas. It's crazy.
If using this technology proves reliable, Payne says it will have huge ramifications for California. One benefit from the aerial surveys is precise knowledge about potential flooding. That's important to water managers like Michael Jackson, who oversees Friant Dam north of Fresno for the Bureau of Reclamation. As we look at water spewing from the dam, he says he expects more than 4 million acre feet to flow out and down the San Joaquin River this spring.
We'll probably end up needing to draw it down below 300,000 acre feet in order to make room for what's shaping up to be a record snowpack.
For Jackson, knowing exactly how much water will flow into Millerton Lake northeast of Fresno is important for flood control, as well as the all-important water allocations for farmers and towns. As the new data continues to come in, the old way of snow surveying won't totally go away. For at least the next few years, water managers will compare the data from the two methods, the old and the new, to see how they measure up. For Here and Now, I'm Ezra David Romero in Fresno.
So there are some things where you just look at them and you say, this is really a big coincidence. And that could be, Robin, the fact that you happened to visit WUNC yes. in North Carolina on the very day that
what?
UNC is playing in the NCAA championship game.
Well, I'm here at WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, because we did coincidentally have a station visit. Although the fact, Jeremy, that I brought my NC cookie cake, you can see on my Twitter feed out here now, Robin, I think helped get me in the door here. It's just a coincidence, but what a great one, because as you know, Jeremy, whatever happens tonight, there could be either crying or celebrating in the streets right. here. The UNC Tar Heels meeting Gonzaga, the Bulldogs. They even sound scary. Gonzaga's like Godzilla. It's the NCAA championship. It's in Glendale, Arizona. It's the culmination of March Madness. And we want to bring in our sports reporter for the day, Jeff Tiberi, Capital Bureau Chief for WUNC's in the studio, because we understand in your dreams you are a sports reporter, Jeff.
I am. Welcome to North Carolina.
Well, thank you. And we're going to be going to the Gonzaga team in a second. But, you know, UNC, they've won five titles. This is the 20th Final Four for the Tar Heels. But it's been tough. I mean, nobody's taking this for granted.
Oh, no, absolutely not. And let's remember that North Carolina lost in the national title game last year to Villanova on a buzzer beater hit by Chris Jenkins. One of the most remarkable shots, truly, in 125 years of basketball.
I can see people on the other side of the glass saying, we did not forget that, Jeff. Let's bring in John Blanchett. He's a sports columnist for the Spokesman Review in Spokane, on the line from Arizona, covering the big game tonight. And so tell us more about Gonzaga. It's a small Catholic school, private school, and they're getting here, John, we understand, is part of a really long plan.
Well, yes, it is. And first of all, it's Gonzaga. Don't let anyone out here in the West hear you say Gonzaga. They're very, very sensitive about it.
I'm so sorry. It's like Nevada. You can't say Nevada. Go ahead.
Yeah, it has been a long journey in one sense and a long plan because really the first seeds of this were sown 20 years ago. But I guess in the big picture of college basketball, college athletics, that's really not that long of a time to wait. It just seems that long to the people here. But it's been a very painstaking process. The program that Coach Mark Few built here became a national entity actually quickly, but the journey to get to the Final Four and the championship game has been painstaking.
Yeah, and if people have a hard time with Gonzaga and the Zags, you've got this player. Pronounce his name, Karnowski.
Shemek Karnowski.
Shemek Karnowski. One of the great names in basketball, but also he's been great this series. So both of you, I want to start with John and Shemek. Talk about some of these big players people might be introduced to for the first time when they tune in tonight.
Well, if they've seen basketball at all, they've probably come across Shemek because he's gotten a lot of attention this year. He's a giant 7'1". He's from Poland, and he has just a massive beard that even enhances his mountain man-like quality, and he's really a spectacle, and he's a very fun individual to talk to and to cover with a great personality. But they have some other interesting players, too. Nigel Williams-Goss, who was a transfer mm-hmm. from the University of Washington and is kind of the spiritual leader, I guess, of this team. They're a team that's kind of interesting, built in an interesting way. International players, transfers from other schools. There's three of them on the roster. And then their first McDonald's All-American high school player, Zach Collins, who had a big role in the semifinal win over South Carolina.
And on North Carolina's side, you have Kennedy Meeks, who he came to North Carolina and was really not ready to play at the highest levels of college basketball. He lost 50 pounds the summer between his freshman and sophomore year, and he's just really been fantastic on the glass for the Tar Heels these past few weeks.
Well, I think after Saturday night's game, you know, anybody walking around outside the championship with a basketball, watch out, he's taking it. I mean, he went up for the rebound. So there's going to be a lot going on under the baskets. But Jeff, you know, talk more about North Carolina and how basketball crazy this area is.
Oh, this is in the culture. This is in the fabric here. And of course, North Carolina is playing in the championship game tonight, but there's Duke, which has five championships of its own. There's North Carolina State, which won the national title in 1974 and 1983. Wake Forest has a rich basketball tradition. And there are other smaller schools here in North Carolina. I mean, everybody has a dog in the fight, or so it seems, when it comes to college basketball here in North Carolina.
Well, and John Blanchett, how much more then does maybe Gonzaga feel like not Godzilla or Goliath, but David? I mean, underdog coming in, which might boost them even more.
Yeah, there's an element of that, but I think you also have to realize that Gonzaga has been a player on the national level now for more than a decade, and they feel very comfortable playing at this level. They don't have the blue blood pedigree that North Carolina does by any stretch, or that level of tradition, but they're not street urchins either. They've played games, they've played big time games both in the regular season and in the NC2A tournament for years. So yeah, I think there's a little underdog element to it, but maybe not as much as people might think.
More Bulldog. John Blanchett, sports columnist for the Spokesman Review in Spokane, Washington. Jeff Tabiri, Capitol Bureau Chief for WUNC here in North Carolina. Big game tonight. Best of luck to both teams.
Great to see you.
A big ad push is kicking into high gear. It's against the so-called border adjustment tax that House Speaker Paul Ryan has proposed as part of the Republican plan to revamp the tax system. A number of conservative organizations are putting out ads against the idea, and the division on that issue is expected to put a wrench in President Trump's plans to overhaul the tax system, which is why Derek Thompson of The Atlantic says the entire process to revamp the tax system will be a nightmare. Derek joins us, as he does each Monday, from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Jeremy.
So the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, said last week that changing the tax system is going to be simpler than changing health care. You don't think so?
No, I don't think so at all. Healthcare was supposed to be simple. Repealing Obamacare, that's something the GOP had voted to do repeatedly for 7 years. They had time to dress rehearse this before it went primetime, and that didn't exactly work out. You know, some people think taxes will be easier. It's not just Mnuchin, it's others. But let's compare healthcare to federal taxes. America's healthcare industry is about 1/6 of the economy, about $3 trillion in total. U.S. federal tax revenue is roughly 1/6 of the economy, or about $3 trillion in total. Healthcare is a complex, amorphous institution. All of these entrenched interests that are trying to struggle for their own part of the pie. Federal taxes are the exact same thing. What one person calls a tax loophole, another person calls an essential benefit to keep their company alive. So I think taxes, if anything, might even be more complicated than healthcare. And the last time we had comprehensive tax overhaul, comprehensive tax reform, 1986 under President Ronald Reagan, that took over a year to get together, even though it was in the second term of a historically popular president. This is a hard, hard thing to do.
Well, and a large part of this plan coming from the Republicans would involve cutting taxes. But there is one new tax, and this is what I want to ask you about, is the border adjustment tax, because this is what's attracting all of this negative attention from conservative groups. How exactly would it work?
The mechanics of this border adjustment tax are complicated, but the outcome is fairly simple. So let's focus on the outcome. It's a really efficient way to tax companies that import and benefit companies that export. So stepping back, what did Donald Trump say he wanted to do with trade on the campaign trail? He said more jobs over here, less companies who do their business overseas, right? Here is a tax plan that would theoretically do that. It would punish companies that keep their income abroad, and it would benefit companies that make stuff here and sell it to the world. On the other hand, it would really hurt a lot of retailers like Target and Walmart, whose business essentially is often to import parts that are cheap and then sell them to Americans for a little bit of a profit. That's their business model. And this tax policy, a $1 trillion plan, would hurt them.
What about the tax cut part of this plan? What are they proposing there?
Paul Ryan and Donald Trump have both proposed tax cuts that are in line with a lot of leading Republicans. They essentially want to bring down marginal rates. They want to give Americans tax cuts that will disproportionately benefit the rich because, to be frank, the rich pay disproportionately more when it comes to the federal income taxes. What they would also like to do is to balance some of the cuts to the marginal rates by also taking away some tax benefits. So sometimes this plan is summarized as lower the rates but broaden the base.
Right.
But once again, like I said, you're going to have liberals on the one hand saying you can't cut taxes that disproportionately benefit the rich, while on the other hand, you're going to have a lot of rich companies saying don't take away the tax benefit that specifically benefits us because then we're going to lose billions of dollars. So tax reform, tax overhauls are always a nightmare. And this is something that I think Mnuchin, the administration, are looking for a quick win with. But there is nothing quick about comprehensive tax reform.
Well, and the argument that they will make and that they already have been making is that tax cuts will pay for themselves. They will lead to economic growth. Now, we've been through this debate many times before. But what does the research say, Derek, about whether or not that's really true?
They just don't. It would be lovely to think that if you cut taxes, then magically you're waving a wand over economic growth and it just jumps up by a few percentage points. But all the research we have suggests this just doesn't happen, that the economy is more complicated than that. In 1993, Bill Clinton raised the top marginal rate, and the 1990s were gangbusters for the economy. In early 2001 and 2003, President George W. Bush cut taxes by an enormous amount on the top 1%, and 6 years later, we were in a great recession. So it's not like a magic wand. I think it is more clear to say the following, that yes, taxes do change incentives on the margins, but taxes are a much better way at collecting money that you can then spend on national initiatives than they are to essentially dial up and dial down the economy as if you have your hand on a thermostat, which is tax rates.
So just very briefly, Derek, do you think that the plan will be to go for something smaller than the big tax overhaul that they've been talking about?
Very briefly, yes, that is exactly what I think is going to happen. I think that they're going to quickly see the tax overhauls are a logistical and procedural nightmare. They're going to be looking for a quick win. And what they're going to do instead is just do a more simple tax cut that expires after 10 years, exactly like George W. Bush did in 2001.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. Today at WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, it's Here and Now.